He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nau mai, whakarongo mai, ki te Aotai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Janina Schwanaker.
Great to have your company. Ko Sally Round tēnei. Today we delve into New Zealand's biggest export market and ask what makes China's consumers tick. And Cosmo's at a farm in North Canterbury to find out about a healthy protein that can be extracted from leafy crops.
I take you to a remote settlement between Gisborne and the Bay of Plenty, where a couple have carved out a niche for themselves, making farm and hunting knives out of deer antlers.
But first, let's find out what's been making headlines on the rural news desk this week. Confirmation of two mill closures in the North Island has left people in nearby rural communities fearing for their future. 230 people lost their jobs with Winstone Pulp International, which has had to shut the plants due to the high cost of electricity. Here's one of the mill workers, Jet Tumataroa.
Our local towns, it's probably going to wreck them, especially a lot of us young ones. We're probably going to disappear off the Aussie or something if we can. So yeah, it's a big loss to the community and to the jobs. So I've recently just brought my house in the beginning of June, so I haven't had it that long. So yeah, got to find a job pretty fast. Well, all my redundancy's pretty much going on my mortgage anyway, so yeah, that's going to be a bit tough.
Meanwhile, Waikato Dairy Cooperative Tatua is expanding, meaning 40 more jobs and a doubling in output of its cream-based products. It's investing $85 million in its Tatanui site in Waikato, expected to be complete within a year. Chief Executive Brendan Graney says the company can't keep up with demand domestically and offshore.
The kiwifruit marketer Zespri is looking at relying less on diesel-powered ships to get its produce to Europe and transitioning to transport run on renewable energy. Zespri spokesperson Rachel Dupree says shipping emissions make up 43% of kiwifruit's overall carbon footprint, and as it wants to be a leader in reducing emissions, it has work to do. She says transitioning to lower-emitting shipping is a huge and expensive exercise and will require collaboration between exporters, ports and the government.
Customers in Europe in particular who are starting to ask us what our climate targets are and the action that we're taking to reduce our emissions and how we can show that, and then regulations. So there are disclosure regulations also coming from the European market, which will require us to detail our action on climate.
The farming leader says more sheep farmers might look to leave the industry as the forecast for the upcoming season remains grim. Beef and Lamb's outlook shows farm profits are forecast to drop 7.4%, despite the slight improvement in demand forecast for red meat globally. Federated Farmers Meat and Wool Chair Toby Williams says lamb prices need to lift 20% to 30% for farmers to break even.
It hasn't been as hard since the 1980s in the Rogenomic areas. We've got some green shoots, interest rates are falling. You know, it looks like spring's been kind so far for most of the country. And lambing, up in the North Island, lambing looks to have been pretty good. But yeah, numbers of lambs aren't going to be able to do it for us now. We need their pricing to really increase.
Meanwhile, the Ministry for Primary Industries has been investigating a Southland farm where sheep were found knee-deep in mud, new lambs struggling to stand, as well as some dead sheep. It came after heavy rain, wind and low temperatures last weekend. Footage was posted on social media by the animal welfare group SAFE. MPI says the farmer has since moved his stock to drier paddocks, and inspectors have been back on the farm to ensure animal welfare.
Orange juice was in the spotlight this week, or rather the lack of it. There have been lower yields of oranges on the east coast due to Cyclone Gabrielle, and a smaller crop out of Brazil, which is the world's largest orange grower. Have a listen to juice maker Bruce Coventry of Living Juices.
Probably once every couple of months I see a small grower give up because of the cost and stringency of certification, especially in the organic side of things. The large companies are the only ones who can really afford to make any decent money because of the compliance issues and the fact that they've got money to produce things at real scale.
Farmers on the Chatham Islands are relieved stocks being offloaded to the mainland, providing a much-needed paycheck. The transport vessel Southern Tiare is back servicing the island twice a month after 4 months out of action. Local farming leader Tony Addison says the ship's going as fast as it can to transport the backlog.
cash flows are just starting to kick in. You know, possibly the first animals have been sold and that they sold very well, and that cash might be just starting to arrive. Unfortunately, with the long lockdown, there no one's got any cash to buy anything, so that's a dual-edged sword. The ships coming back with not a lot of cargo in it because the economy is going to take some time to recover.
After a complete ban on whitebedding last year following Cyclone Gabrielle, the new whitebedding season in Hawke's Bay is off to a solid start. I had a chat to Alex Sutton, who's a regular figure on the Tukituki River with his whitebedding nets.
I've been out 8 days, and day 2, 3 and 6 were very good. The other 5 were zero. So that's how whitebait flow. They might be there one day and they might not be there the next. But those 3 days that I did get a reasonable haul, that added up to 3 kilograms.
And just lastly, Peter Nation is stepping down from the helm of the Southern Hemisphere's largest agricultural event, the National Field Days, held annually at Mystery Creek. He's worked with the National Field Days Society for nearly 30 years and was appointed chief executive in 2016. And that's a wrap from RNZ's Rural News team.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
China is the biggest market for our primary produce, particularly dairy. And our guest this week knows that market as well as a cow cocky knows his herd. Mark Tanner founded the firm China Skinny more than a decade ago. It's based in Shanghai and helps brands from around the world understand the Chinese market. I caught up with Mark in between trips, and he told me it's the first time he's seen consumption there quite so flat, with no sign of things improving anytime soon, especially with the continuing lackluster property market.
And now a lot more price sensitive than they have been in the past. So they're now switching from formerly premium products to more value focused goods, a lot of domestic products. Obviously a lot of New Zealand commodities still feed into those domestic made goods, and there's obviously a still large niche in China that's prepared to pay whatever it takes to get the cleanest, greenest, safest, healthiest food and beverage products they can. But as a whole, consumption, the average price of consumer goods has decreased across many categories.
Now, I've heard that you try and understand the trends in consumer behaviour in China by the state of the bubble tea market or the milk tea market. Why is that?
Well, I think milk tea is really well reflective of just what's happening in the market. It wasn't long ago, maybe even 6 months ago, there was a lot of brands that were really approaching that premium market, $5, $6 for a cup of pretty fancy looking sugary drink. And people were prepared to pay a premium for drinks they thought were fresher, healthier, no sugar. But with the drops in sentiment, you're seeing more and more of these formerly premium brands competing on price. So there's a lot of products that are now down to 10 kuai, which is about a little over $2. Consumers are just not prepared as often to pay that premium price for that, for those perceived benefits.
Will that affect dairy that New Zealand produces? Because
in some ways,
milk tea is made up of milk, isn't it?
There's the wacky cream cheese that everyone's seen, but obviously milk's a big part of it because New Zealand exports the vast majority of milk to China, will likely be less impacted than other exporters. But in saying that, a lot of these brands, because they're trying to compete on price, they're looking to cut costs in any way they can, which could mean looking at cheaper sources of milk.
So a risk for the New Zealand dairy industry there.
And particularly some of the fruit as well. But a lot of the fruit right now is domestically grown. It's not the high quality premium products that New Zealand does so well at.
Well, let's just sort of dive a little bit deeper into that profile of the consumer in China. Can you give us a little bit more of a feeling for the trends there? Are they more health conscious, more environmentally conscious, or time poor, for instance?
Time poor is a big one. And the C word, convenience, is on everyone's lips in China. If it's not convenient, most consumers are not very interested. They want things here and now, and you can order something on your phone and in many cases have it delivered within 30 minutes. So there's that kind of expectation around everything they buy. Sustainability and environment, there's a lot of talk about that and a lot of surveys, and if you look on the surface, China looks very environmentally aware. EVs are everywhere. There's more EVs sold in China than the rest of the world put together. Public transport usage, all these types of things. A lot of people on bicycles and people are, on the surface, seem quite focused on saving the world. But if you actually look at consumer behavior, the association with health and safety and cleanliness is why they buy sustainable food and beverage. They're not buying it to save the world or to keep New Zealand rivers clean. They're more concerned it's more of an individual benefit they see. They think if it's environmentally friendly, it's unlikely to have chemicals and all sorts of other nasties that will could make them sick. So that's kind of the main driver behind the sustainability movement in China. It's really important to not view China as one massive homogenous market. China is incredibly varied. Even in a city like Shanghai, you have those that are not price conscious at all, that are very sustainability focused. And so it's about sorting out your tribe and really targeting in on who they are. What we're seeing now is the lower tier cities are starting to really show their own. And everyone's been talking about the hinterland, the lower tier cities, as long as I've been in China. But until quite recently, a lot of the consumers were very, very price sensitive, very basic in their needs and unlikely to buy premium New Zealand products. Whereas now you're starting to see that these consumers in tier 3, 4 and even 5 cities are among the most optimistic. And you see retail spending is increasing much faster than cities like Shanghai and Beijing.
It's tough for our sheep and beef farmers at the moment. The value of our meat exports into China have fallen to the lowest in 6 years. What is driving that?
There's some meat coming in from Latin America, which is flooding the market, and that's low cost. They're always having variances in different rules, and different countries are getting banned and not banned, and that's opening up. So it's hard to keep track at times. But there's that coupled with consumers aren't spending as much, and beef is definitely a more premium protein than that mainstay of pork, which is obviously when you're not feeling as wealthy, you're probably going to go to your more low cost and your feel good meats. But at the same time, that health is one of the traits that's really stayed true. Even since when I first arrived in 2010, it was quite nascent. People were really talking about health and the way they eat. But with COVID, it really accelerated. Health, to use a cliche, became the new wealth, and people prioritize their health in front of everything. Consumers are definitely, as a whole, increasing, or as a percentage, I should say, increasing their consumption of the red meats as opposed to the porks. Our biggest threat is the likes of Latin America coming in, undercutting us, and consumers not valuing our quality as opposed to the mass producer, and quite inconsistent products coming from Latin America. Now, New Zealand obviously has grass-fed, which is unique relative to a lot of the sources of protein. But obviously that's may not taste as good for some of these consumers. But if we can really kind of hammer home that health angle, I think that's our best approach.
How is the New Zealand brand regarded by Chinese consumers? Do they know much about it?
We've been to some far-flung places in the absolute middle of nowhere, and you get some peasant that obviously hasn't probably had much of an education, but you tell him you're from New Zealand, and he'll say, oh, every single person I've met in China knows about it. They all say about the milk. That's a big one in Lord of the Rings. But they do know it, and they do hold it in quite high esteem. At China Skinny, we do work with brands from countries all across the world, and we'll often look into the origin and perceptions of origin, whether for a New Zealand brand or not. But New Zealand, particularly in food and beverage, always scores right up there. It's usually top, if not in the top few. Things like red meat, Australia scores a little bit higher, sadly. A lot of kind of healthy, fresh products, New Zealand really does have this great brand.
So if I was a honey producer or a woolen sock producer, what should I be doing to get into the China market?
I'd really look at it and say, is it the right market for me? Because just trying to kind of dip your toes, you're probably on hiding to nothing in a market like China, because there's so many competitors that are really aggressive and really assertive. But if you genuinely are committed to it, I would focus on really defining your specific target audience, and that would be the demographics, the tribal kind of characteristics, the geographies, and then really doubling down on just that rather than being quite generic and meaningless. Dairy is a really good example. A lot of foreign brands come in and they sell good old plain white milk. The average consumer in China wants something a little more than that. So if they're buying it for their kids, they want milk that helps their kids sleep at night, or helps their kids' brain development, or helps their kids' bones get strong, and all these funny, quite specific functions and benefits. So the good thing about China is the niches are huge. So it's a case of kind of figuring out what your niche is and then doing it really, really well.
I was talking there to Mark Tanner of China Skinny. And you can hear more of Mark's observations on the Chinese market by heading to the Country Life podcast episode, which features him. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Now we're heading to Okuora Farms in the Hurunui district. Cosmo's sheltering in the farmyard with Maury Leyland, who owns the property with her husband, John Penno.
We're very close to the mouth of the Hurunui River, so just a couple of kilometres back from the mouth. And today it's bleak.
We are standing in a machinery shed because it's driving rain, isn't it? And quite cold too.
I think it's going to get colder. I'd be very happy to show you around, but you're not in full wet weather gear, so it may not be the day.
Yeah. Now tell me what you are doing here on this farm.
Yeah, we, John and I bought this farm in March 2020, you know, as things would go. So right as we all went into lockdown. And we've been spending a lot of time thinking about farming and the future of farming, and not just the farming itself, but the future of exporting out of New Zealand and high value exports out of New Zealand. And so as part of our journey through that, we really wanted to be experiencing farming. John grew up on a farm. He's a, you know, long-term farmer. So we got into sheep and beef farming with a plan to learn and to experience what's going on in the industry, but also to diversify, so to identify what higher value options there could be for good quality sheep and beef country that diversify from, you know, the standard dairying. So that's what we set out to do, and we're 4 years into that journey. Not a straightforward journey, as you could imagine.
And prior to that, you were working with Fonterra?
Yeah, I am an Aucklander originally. Started my career as an engineer. I was marine-oriented rather than agriculturally oriented. Then I was a strategy consultant for a decade, and then I went to Fonterra. Spent more than a decade there, and a lot of time on the executive team, seeing a lot of the big changes that Fonterra went through during that era.
Yes. Yeah. And John, of course, is a co-founder of Synlait, and for quite a few years he was the managing director and CEO.
Yeah, that's right. His journey was through farming, agricultural science. For a long time, he was a leading scientist and consulting officer and really working in that field. He then turned that to business and started Synlait, first from a farming perspective and then building that business. Yeah, so we've both got the dairying background, but very different angles to it.
Tell me about the farm. How much land have you got?
700 hectares, either side of the river. And it's, you know, nearly 400 hectares of beautiful, flat, irrigated land, really deep soils, so lovely horticultural grade soils. And then the remainder is rolling and steep hill country. So a bit of a mix, but some really beautiful soils.
Yes. So you came here with some ideas for diversification.
Yep. We had an interest and some knowledge in hops, and the hops industry at the time was going really well. So we immediately put in 3.5 hectares of hops in the same year and 0.5 hectare of pip fruit. At the time, we weren't so excited about pip fruit, but the opportunity to learn. So we put in a trial garden. We've got about 20 different varieties of apples, pears, cherries. But we felt if we're doing trialing anyway, let's learn about what could really, really grow here. And at the same time, we also set about doing some development in terms of irrigation and, you know, the infrastructure for the sheep and beef farm.
How big a role did climate change have on your decision to plant hop gardens and orchards?
Well, certainly we did a lot of looking, you know, we dug a lot of holes, but we also did a lot of looking at historical climate data before we made the decision to do this. And One thing we noted was that the climate here now is similar to the Nelson Tasman Bays region in the 70s. So that shift of things moving a bit further south. So that was in our minds in terms of areas that maybe have been considered inappropriate for horticulture in the past, getting more appropriate.
We can see your hop gardens from this shed here, and of course everything's very dormant.
Yep, we finished our harvest in the beginning of April, and 5 minutes down the road we've got our hop shed, and so we've got a big wolf hop picker in the kilns. So it's not just the harvesting, you're harvesting and processing each season. So we imported a second-hand picker from Germany and we've built the kilns ourselves. If we were going to go much bigger, obviously you'd want to go sort of state-of-the-art, but while we've been in the trial stage, I think we've managed to get it going really well, actually.
Mm. Has a brewery used your hops yet to make beer?
Yeah, well, the thing with hops, unlike some other horticultural crops, is that we put them in the ground in September 2020 and we harvested our first varieties, actually in this shed here, which is no longer our hop shed, in March 21. So they're a pretty short cycle. But yes, so our varieties have been well used. Castle's made some beautiful brews this year.
Oh, Castle's in Christchurch.
Yep, that's right. We really like the whole local flavour. You know, we're doing this because we're passionate about Canterbury, about future opportunities for Canterbury, both in terms of our economy and the environment. So to have the chance to work with local breweries is definitely very much within our sights.
So what do you do on the rest of the farm?
Sheep and beef and dairy grazing. Probably more dairy grazing than we originally thought we'd be doing when we set out. But, I mean, you'll be well aware that the meat industry, particularly sheep, is pretty grim. And although dairy farmers are having a tough time, it's a lot better than the sheep and beef. So dairy grazing, you know, has been a real opportunity for us that we're making the most of. So we carry a lot of dairy heifers and cows over winter and graze calves all year round. We're growing winter crops as well as the barley, so we've got a reasonable cropping operation.
And you've also been growing lucerne here for a venture you've started called Leafed.
Yeah. In our first year, yes, we did grow some of the lucerne here. However, Leafed is based out of Rolleston, and we're actually working with local arable farmers in Southbridge who are growing for us there and nice and close to our operation.
Yes. Tell our listeners more about Leafed Foods.
So Leafed Foods is extracting protein from leafy forage crops, something that we are phenomenally excited about and it's making huge leaps and bounds. We're about to come to market soon.
And so what is this protein?
The protein from leafy green crops is called Rubisco. It's the enzyme behind photosynthesis and it's the most abundant protein in the world. So it's long been known about for well over a century that if you could extract it, it was an incredible source of protein. And it's also been known that it's got a full amino acid profile, that it's soluble, that it would be high yielding, and all these other features. The challenge has been nobody's been able to extract it. So we started out in 2018 and sort of trying to see if it was a viable opportunity. And yeah, indeed, our team are doing a phenomenal job of extracting the protein. So technologically, they're nailing it at yields which are exciting and in a process which is highly circular. So the fact that we have this farming system here in New Zealand and we can incorporate what we're doing with Leafed, we can incorporate that farm system into standard farming is a real, you know, is a real plus.
Yes, and how did you come across the idea in the first place?
The team have all arrived, so I might have a bit of background noise.
No worries.
Yeah, we got the concept. We were at a hackathon at Lincoln University, organised by Blink, their innovation unit. And at this hackathon, there were people standing up with their ideas for, you know, the future of food, you know, type ideas. And a plant and food scientist at the end of his career, Rod McDonald, got up and he talked about the concept of extracting protein from leafy crops.
Yes.
And it really sparked our imagination. So following that, we went to see him and learn more about it. I bought a book off the internet because there were books about the technology that had been developed over the past century. And then I had a go at making it at home. and it was enough to say, this might have some potential. So, you know, we could see many challenges and things that might not work ahead, but we pulled together an amazing team pretty early on, and we worked really hard on understanding what assumptions needed to be true for it to work. So I think that's been really beneficial. We've known what milestones we've needed to hit.
Yes. Yeah. And so why have you chosen lucerne as the main protein producing crop?
Lucerne's a really well-known crop globally. It was actually the first forage crop to be domesticated by humans because it travelled the world with humans and their horses. And we've grown lucerne in New Zealand for a very long time, so we also know it well here. It fits really well into farming systems. It's a highly productive plant. It's perennial. It fixes its own nitrogen. It's deep-rooted, so it's drought-tolerant. So we like all those things about it. Yeah. It's not very active in winter, so we've got a real interest in other crops too. As the term in dairy goes, square the curve, you know, so that we've got winter production as well, and we're making some really good progress on other varieties which also fit well into a farming system.
Yes. Yeah. What do you make with the protein?
One of the important decisions that we made early on, which isn't always a standard New Zealand decision, was that we're going to bring a product to market direct to consumers. So one of the things about Rubisco, it's highly functional, so it's soluble, it foams, it's gels, so everything from, you know, the high performance sport type applications to middle-aged women like me, you know, you're looking to increase protein in your diet. If you can think of a use that's going to use protein, then Rubisco is probably going to fit. And we're aiming for the higher value uses. Yeah.
That's great. And so once you've extracted the Rubisco from the lucerne, what happens to the leftover plant? Does it have any value?
Yeah, so our early economic models said we're going to be making a silage from the fibre, if you like, and we need to find a way to get some commercial value from that. And what we've learnt is that it's a protein-reduced silage, but it's also macerated, so it's easy for an animal to digest. So actually for a dairy cow, for example, if she's consuming our silage, she's getting... A dairy cow today actually consumes too much protein, and therefore she has to work hard to process that, turn it into urea, excrete it as urine. So a macerated product that she can digest easily, where the protein she can't absorb is not there anymore, actually has better outcomes in terms of her environmental performance, in terms of her emissions. And that's been a really important part of our model, is to ensure that all our co-products have a really valuable economic home. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, Leafed Foods has secured some serious investment too.
Yep. One of the goals in what we've been doing there is we want to see change. We want real opportunities for change at scale in terms of them being value creating and environmentally a step up on where we've been. So if we weren't going to do something which was substantial, then maybe we could have done something easier. I don't know. Yeah. And so the goal of doing something which has real potential for scale has always been the driver. So we did a Series A capital raise, which we concluded in March 22. And that brought on board Cosler Ventures, ACC, Naitahu, and Stephen Adams. So they came on board then.
Some high-profile names.
Yeah, and a really nice mix of... I think Cosler Ventures are an incredible VC firm out of Silicon Valley, incredibly supportive and been hugely beneficial to us. And Naitahu and ACC, just really important strategic alignment in terms of the common goals and interests and what we're trying to achieve and the ability to work together on that.
Mm. Mm. So what is the next step?
Well, we're in our winter shut period, much like a dairy factory.
Yes.
we're scaling up to go into a big spring and get products into market.
Maury Leyland there, talking to Cosmo Kentish Barnes about plant protein and growing hops at Oku Ora Farms in North Canterbury.
My name is Sarah Maxwell. I am a farmer from Fielding in the Manawatū, and you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Now, my last trip to the East Coast had me chasing waterfalls, from the running Rere Falls to the roar of those in Motu, halfway between Gisborne and Whakatane. It was here that I met a sharp couple who have found a new way to repurpose deer antlers. That rushing sound is the Motu Falls, located about an hour northwest of Gisborne. On the hill just above me live Jacinda and Richie Sheridan, a couple turning deer antlers into beautiful treasures that last a lifetime.
I'm Jacinda Sheridan. We live in Motu, northwest of Gisborne. We're farming, but we're here for Sheridan Hunting Knives, so I am the artist behind the business.
And I am possibly the brawn. putting the knives together is my job. Jacinda designs the carvings, and we just go like that here at this stage. I like it here because it's an isolated block. Yeah, sheep and beef currently running 470 hectares in Motu, just straight sheep and beef. It suits me, suits my lifestyle. Yeah, it's a real cool place to work in.
And how did you guys start the knife carving business, I suppose? Where did when did that start, and how did you get into it? Was it sort of a hobby initially?
Yeah, well, I started 30 years ago as a hobby. I was making them out of the cross-cut saw blades that you cut the big old trees down. And that slowly progressed into antler handles. And right at the beginning, I'd ball the antler handles to soften the bone marrow in the middle so I can whack the blade into them. And then that progressed on to putting a bunch of brass on the back of them, right down to $2 coins. I found brass complemented the antler, and it just made it look a lot more prettier. And over time, it's just progressed into proper brass bar, proper handle, glue, everything's pretty much uniformed, very made pretty much the same way, and the carving now, so my wife does the carving.
Rich always made knives, that was a hobby of his. We were living way up the coast on a station called Pukitoro, and it actually rained for 3 weeks. There'd been this Dremel sitting in the shed for about 18 months, and out came this Dremel, and out came the knife work, and Rich is on YouTube, and he's figuring out how to carve, and I'm looking over his shoulder going, the horse looks like a cow. and it sort of went from there. I took a turn at it, and I was actually quite good at it, and showing them to our shepherds and stuff, and they were encouraging us to, and you know, wanted us to make them for them. Them, put their names on them and things like that, and then suggested we use social media. So that was, you know, 12 years ago or something, and initially just putting them on our own pages, our personal pages, and threw out friends and stuff like that, and then actually building a business page and going from there.
The couple run Sheridan Hunting Knives from home, operating out of a spare shed between working jobs on the farm.
I suppose one of the good things about being a farmer is there's always lots of outsheds you can turn into studios.
And my pen.
That we share. Yeah. In town we had a workshop, and then we had the studio where the shop that we work from as well.
Yeah.
So I could do a lot of engraving and stuff in the shop quietly. Yeah, now we make do with what we've got, which is a shed.
Well, it's a well-stocked shed as well.
Yeah.
See some farm dogs, and we've got some chooks wandering around.
Yeah, chooks.
Yeah. Keep you company.
Yeah.
As you can see there's lots of handler. I'm actually down to just about no handles left.
I can see because some of these are cut, and so
yeah,
kind
I'll
of
cut,
you
cut the best stuff off.
Yeah.
Ones that we've used.
Do you mind if I ask what you do with the leftover bits?
So we trade it for we go to antler merchant and we trade it. Just he gives me what stuff that I want, and he takes what I don't need. So it works both ways, yeah. It's quite good. It's getting quite hard to sort of source these days because it's worth a bit of money. But yeah, there's ways around it.
Red deer are the most common species found in New Zealand, being both farmed for venison meat and velvet and running wild as a pest species. Lucky for the Sheridans, who find it's the easiest type of antler to work with.
It's very, very tricky to find the right size antler. It's got to be the right size, right colour, right shape, so that can be a bit tedious. But I do have lots of friends that are hunters, and we did deal with the antler merchant, and I'd go and see him. It's a natural resource of the country that's quite good to be able to use rather than just hang on a wall as such. And people get a lot of enjoyment out of their knife being made out of their stag. It just gives it a bit of extra personal thing. But saying that, not all people's knives, probably 90% of them are antler that I have sourced. Mm. Yeah, pretty much.
And all types of deer as well.
All types of deer, right down to Samba, Rusa, Sika, Fallow Reds. Haven't done anything with Wapiti, not like a member Wapiti ones, but no. So yeah, it's pretty much all types of deer in.
Most of the antler we are doing for most of our customers is red deer.
Yep, red deer.
Yeah, but we, you know, if we acquire bits of Samba or a Sika and things like that, we save those for those one-off sort of custom orders.
Is there, like, do you find one species of deer antler easier to work with when you're carving, or...?
100% red deer.
Red deer.
yeah. Antler is really tricky. It's not like carving sheep bone or beef bone or anything. It's quite it bites in. So the less grain or bark you could call it, the exterior of the antler, the easier it is once I strip it back.
The harder the shell seems to be better. So deer antler obviously isn't like a normal bone, and it has a bone marrow as such. And some of the deer antler has a thicker wall, the outside wall with less bone marrow. And the thicker the wall, the better it is for us. Well, for JC to carve, because it's a solider surface. So yeah, and you'll get like the likes of fallow deer, it's got a very skinny wall.
Yeah.
With a big, large amount of bone marrow. And you go down to Rusa and Sika, they have a big thick wall.
Dense.
And it's always, and those knives are always a bit heavier because of the density of the wall. And they actually make a prettier knife, and this makes it a bit easier for JC to carve those denser walls.
Do you want to show me how it's done? What does it start with?
Well, it starts with just a natural deer antler handle, just like that. Brass bar, which is that stuff there, and I put that on there and draw around the antler so I get the shape, draw a finger guard, and then more or less just draw, shape it up on this little linisher here. This is the linisher. Use all sorts of different kinds of sandpaper grit. As the front will go on, I cut a wee hole where the knife's going to go in, then hollow out the bit of the antler, and then shape the knife twang to fit the antler. Every antler is different, so every twang's different, nothing's ever the same. There's never two pieces of antler the same in the world. They might be similar, but they're never exactly the same, so every knife is one of a kind, to be fair.
That's pretty cool.
There's no ifs or buts about it. Yeah, I can't. They're all unique. And then, obviously, bang it all together, put the brass bar on, shine them all up, and happy days, yeah. It's a bit of a process. It does take time, but no, it's good. So the antler goes in there, and then I proceed to whack the blade in with the hammer, which will... Once the blade's in, we go to the next step, and that's putting the back on, the brass button.
How many hours would you say roughly goes into kind of start to finish for say, one knife?
Probably say 3.5 to 4 hours.
Wow, so a lot of time. And
yeah.
Is it quite hard juggling that side of the business with, you know, running a farm as well, or being involved in the running of one?
Yes, it is. I'm obviously busy man on the farm, and it does take up time. Yes, definitely takes up time, but we sort of like it. We're passionate about it, and it's just a cool thing. Yeah, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, we're at home a lot. I mean, we love where we live. We're not really remote. We're only about an hour from town, but you know, we're the last house at the end of the road, and we're homebodies. We like to stay at home. We like where we live. That's why we live here. So yeah, it's a little bit of a work-life balance. Typically, a lot of most of our orders are made to order. So our turnaround, we say, is 4 weeks. I mean, you could always get your order earlier than that, but it's about balancing, Rich? Balancing farm work,
yeah.
Weekends, three children, and the side hustle, yeah. So we've been back on farm for 4 to 5 years now. Yeah. When we were full-time, like I actually wouldn't even be able to put a number on it, but we've made thousands. I'd say we're well into the thousands now, yeah. It can be a feast or a famine now that we've sort of slowed it down and we do an organic trade. But I don't know, Rich, where would you put it at?
Oh, easily a couple hundred a year, I would think. Mm. Well, we haven't actually sat down and worked it out. It's just not one sort of stuff that we do, but you'd be talking over the years in the thousands, definitely in the thousands.
So originally, like Richie said earlier, he was making them out of old crosscut blades. When we decided to make this into a bit of a full-time gig business, we had to be a little bit more sharper. I mean, if we carried on doing the crosscut blades, we pretty much outpriced ourselves in the market and we couldn't make a mainstream business. So we decided to source a New Zealand-made knife blank. Luckily enough, we were able to do that. So the stainless steel itself is imported from Germany, but the blades are manufactured and fabricated within New Zealand. Yeah, so making our entire product 100% New Zealand made, which is fantastic.
Jacinda's carvings in the handle of the knife add to what make them so unique. After many years' experience, she's got a good eye and a steady hand, though it still pays to double-check the spelling sometimes.
So once Richie's finished with making the knife and we've fabricated the brass and put it together in bits and pieces, then it comes to me for carving. I might do a team of dogs, or I might do a guy or a woman on horseback with a team of dogs, hunting scenes, stags, roaring stags, fighting, dogs bailing boars. But, you know, I also get those one-off commission custom things as well, which might be their Scottish crest or some other out-of-the-box sort of thing, duck hunting scenes, trout, marlin, yeah, you name it.
You write down a rodeo, whatever they want, really, we can carve. Yeah, it's not really an issue, but it's quite entertaining sometimes what they want carved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Helicopters mustering Brahmin cattle and some of those Aussie clients and, yeah, yeah. There's nothing that really we can't do it, but our artwork is, the artwork that I do is silhouette carved, yeah. There's a lot of cleaning up that I have to do on the front of the front finger guard with the blade from residue brass and glue, so I tidy all that up. And then I'll obviously brand it, so I sign it off that we've made it and the year that it's been produced, which is quite cool when people come back and say, oh, well, I've had this because it's the, you know, the years on the blade and all good things like that. And then it's a matter of looking at their actual order and what they want and making sure I spell it right. I've done that a couple of times. I wouldn't want to be doing it now that we're 10 years deep, but accidents have happened. So yeah, it's a matter of stripping back what I call the bark of the antler. So I take it back to the white bone and then I'll etch the scene or the name or Pacifics, whatever they like, onto it, strip all the antler away so it produces a pop of the picture, silt it out, and then lacquer it up so that the picture holds. A lot of people have blade engraving as well, or brass bolster engraving, like it might be a significant 60th birthday present or what have you. So I'll engrave on the brass end of the knife or an inscription on the blade. Bits and pieces like that. Then it goes to dry and I typically leave them to set for at least 24 hours. I'll re-lacquer it again, leave it to set for another 24 hours, and then box it all together, polish it all up, take all the stripping tape that I've used and covered up the metals with while I've been doing the lacquer process, and polish her all up and put it together and post her off where she's meant to go. So this knife I've got here is not the knife that I want. This knife. That's the knife. So this knife that I've got here, Young Farmers have created a Tairāwhiti group, so for the Gisborne region. Hasn't been a staunch following within Gisborne, so it's great that they're getting on board and getting that going. So they've got a bark up and we've sponsored a knife. So I'm just going to engrave the blade with Gisborne Young Farmers bark up 2024.
And it's got three lovely little barking dogs just to match.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of beautiful.
Okay, so just...
there's no way to sort of keep the streamline because every piece of antler is different. Every knife takes its own shape. So when it comes to the placement of the engraving on the blade, I sort of just have to do it by eye and then find a center point. So I just sort of get my lines here and I sort of just put a rough line on the blade just so it's within proportion. This one's going to have two lines on it. The bit I use is a diamond edged bit for the engraving. That's the only thing that's going to work with stainless steel.
Almost looks like a shearing handpiece, the way it's set up and everything.
Yeah.
The knives carry a great deal of sentimental value, and the couple enjoy the variety of requests they've had over the years.
A lot of our gifts are really sentimental gifts, like we might be asked to use someone's own antler of their grandfather shot a stag, and then his son's now getting his first knife and into hunting or going farming or something like that. So there's a lot of sentimentalness behind a lot of the knives that we build. Wedding gifts, 21st gifts, you name it. Like, we do a lot, and we do a lot for a lot of different kind of people, but predominantly farmers, hunters. Yeah, occasionally, we had this lovely guy once. His grandfather was a greengrocer, and he asked us to rebuild his grandfather's knife in our style. But it was his greengrocer's knife that he used for opening the old veggie boxes and stuff. So, I mean, we get a lot of out-of-the-box stuff, not stock standard as well, but, yeah, it's quite colourful.
Yeah, the personal side of the knives, like when you put a person's name in their knife, whether it's a grandfather or son's, daughter's, it just becomes more of a, I think it's more of a personal thing, and they seem to really enjoy having that, and they have it for the rest of their life. I find that's probably the main point of the difference with the knives to compete to other knives in half a sale in the country.
What would an item like this kind of set you back, roughly?
Knives, stock standard hunting, rural farm knives, kitchen knives, they are a set price of $229.99. From there, you build on it. So if you are after carving and or blade engraving, that'll cost you additional. I don't price it as in the art, I just price it as in, you know, the time and detail that goes into it. So carving can sort of start from around $50 to $60, $35 if it's just initials, and blade engraving starts from about $25. Yeah, you can add sheath and steel combos to that, that's $125. So if you were just looking at a knife with a sheath and steel and your name carved into it, you'd be looking just over $400 plus postage. Yeah.
What's the general kind of like lifespan of a knife like this if someone's looking after it?
Oh, it would last you forever. Yeah. I mean, unless it was high use. If it was high use, then you are, you know, like anything, you're going to whittle your blade down, eh, Rich? What would you say about that?
Yeah, anything between, well, I would think anywhere between 10 to 15, 20 years, depending on the use. They are organic matter. And you know, you do not want to put them in the dishwasher as such, or wash them in the hot water. But because we lacquer them with the spray coat a couple of times, that sort of tends to keep all the moisture out of them. But to be fair, they should last you a lifetime, unless, like JC said, it's very high use and they wear out the blade. And you have to be doing a lot of use to wear out the blade because they're high quality of stainless steel, and they should last a long time.
With a final polish, it's done. And off to find a new home with the local young farmers chapter.
And that's us for now. It's great to have your feedback and ideas. You can let us know by emailing country@rnz.co.nz.
Click follow on your app if you don't want to miss an episode of Country Life. And if you enjoyed the podcast, we'd love you to give us a plug on social media or tell a friend about the show. Click the share button in this app to send this episode to a friend.
The stories in this episode were produced and presented by Janina Schwanaker, myself, Sally Round, and Cosmo Kentish-Barnes. In the studio production team today, David Knowles and William Saunders.
Catch you next time.
Ka kite.